Mass propaganda, she wrote, discovered that its audience was ready at all times to believe the worst, no matter how absurd, and did not particularly object to being deceived because it held every statement to be a lie anyhow. The totalitarian mass leaders based their propaganda on the correct psychological assumption that, under such conditions, one could make people believe the most fantastic statements one day, and trust that if the next day they were given irrefutable proof of their falsehood, they would take refuge in cynicism. Instead of deserting the leaders who had lied to them, they would protest that they had known all along that the statement was a lie, and would admire the leaders for their superior tactical cleverness. Russia still uses propaganda to achieve these very same ends, to distract and exhaust its own people, and increasingly citizens of foreign countries, to wear them down through such a profusion of lies that they cease to resist and retreat back into their private lives. A Rand Corporation report called this Putin model of propaganda the fire hose of falsehood, an unremitting high-intensity stream of lies, partial truths, and complete fictions spewed forth with tireless aggression to obfuscate the truth and overwhelm and confuse anyone trying to pay attention. Russian propaganda makes no commitment to objective reality, the report observes. Manufactured sources are sometimes used, and so is manufactured evidence. Faked photographs, faked on-scene news reporting, staged footage with actors playing victims of manufactured atrocities or crimes. Russian news channels, such as RT and Sputnik News, the report goes on, are more like a blend of infotainment and disinformation than fact-checked journalism, though their formats intentionally take the appearance of proper news programs. Russian propaganda, which was extensively exported in the run-up to the 2016 U.S. election and elections in Europe, is cranked out quickly in response to breaking news, and it's endlessly recycled, in high volume at high spin rates, through various media channels to feed the perception of multiple sources. Because Russian trolls are unconcerned with veracity or inconsistencies, they can often get their fictional version of events out before legitimate news organizations can post accurate accounts, taking advantage of the psychological tendency of people to accept the first information received on a topic, and, as the Rand report observes, then favor this information when faced with conflicting messages. The sheer volume of disinformatia unleashed by the Russian firehose system, much like the more improvised but equally voluminous stream of lies, scandals, and shocks emitted by Trump, his GOP enablers, and media apparatchiks, tends to overwhelm and numb people, while simultaneously defining deviancy down and normalizing the unacceptable. Outrage gives way to outrage fatigue, which gives way to the sort of cynicism and weariness that empowers those disseminating the lies. As the former world chess champion and Russian pro-democracy leader Garry Kasparov tweeted in December 2016, the point of modern propaganda isn't only to misinform or push an agenda. It is to exhaust your critical thinking, to annihilate truth. Choose your metaphor. Muddying the waters, throwing chum to the sharks, cranking up the fog machine, flinging gorilla dust in the public's eyes. It's a tactic designed to create adrenal fatigue and news exhaustion, a strategy perfectly designed for our ADD information overloaded age. This twittering world, in T.S. Eliot's words, where people can be distracted from distraction by distraction. In the digital era, sowing confusion online through a barrage of misinformation and disinformation is actually becoming the go-to tactic of propagandists around the world, says the scholar Zeynep Tufekci in her insightful book, Twitter and Tear Gas. In the networked public sphere, Tufekci writes, the goal of the powerful often is not to convince people of the truth of a particular narrative, or to block a particular piece of information from getting out. That is increasingly difficult. But to produce resignation, cynicism, and a sense of disempowerment among the people. This can be done, she notes, in a variety of ways. Inundating audiences with information, producing distractions to dilute their attention and focus, delegitimizing media that provides accurate information, deliberately sowing confusion, fear, and doubt, creating or claiming hoaxes, and generating harassment campaigns designed to make it harder for credible conduits of information to operate. The contemporary Russian master of propaganda, Vladislav Surkov, who's been called the real genius of the Putin era, has employed all these techniques and more in helping to engineer Putin's rise to and consolidation of power. In fact, the tradecraft of the Russian agents who carried out a sophisticated campaign of disinformation during the 2016 presidential campaign bears many of the hallmarks of Surkov's stage management. The journalist Peter Pomerantsev, the author of the book Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, has described Surkov as the impresario who turned Russian politics into a reality show in which democratic institutions are maintained without any democratic freedoms. He helped invent a new strain of authoritarianism based not on crushing opposition from above, Pomerantsev wrote in 2014, but on climbing into different interest groups and manipulating them from inside. For instance, nationalist leaders like Vladimir Zhirinovsky would play the right-wing buffoon to make Mr. Putin look moderate by contrast. With one hand, Pomerantsev went on, Mr. Surkov supported human rights groups made up of former dissidents. With the other, he organized pro-Kremlin youth groups like Nashi, which accused human rights leaders of being tools of the West. Playing all sides against one another to create chaos was a way to ensure that the Kremlin held all the puppet strings while using disinformation to remake reality. This same sort of Surkovian manipulation informed Russian efforts to disrupt the 2016 U.S. election by impersonating Americans and grassroots political groups on social media. As described in a 37-page indictment brought by the special counsel Robert Mueller, the scheme was a sophisticated one, involving hundreds of operatives working for the Internet Research Agency, the Russian troll farm based in St. Petersburg. These agents, some of whom visited the United States under false pretenses, set up hundreds of fake social media accounts, posing as, and sometimes stealing the identities of real Americans, and using an American server to mask their location in Russia. Using these fictional personas, the Russians posted material on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, and built up substantial followings. Their mission? To spread derogatory information about Hillary Clinton, and during the primaries, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, and distrust about the political system in general. In addition to trying to widen schisms among voters over issues like immigration, religion, and race, the Russians spread fake news aimed at boosting Trump's popularity and hurting Clinton's. They also helped organize and promote pro-Trump rallies, spread rumors of voter fraud by the Democratic Party, and began to encourage U.S. minority groups not to vote in the election, or to vote for a third-party candidate. Some of the Russian operatives' moves seemed like cynical pieces of Surkovian stagecraft, recruiting a real American to hold a sign depicting Clinton and a phony quotation attributed to her. I think Sharia law will be a powerful new direction of freedom. Hiring one American to build a large cage on a flatbed truck, and a second American to wear a costume, portraying Clinton in a prison uniform. Surkov's goal in Russia was always the same, Pomerantsev argued in Politico, to keep the great 140 million-strong population reeling with oohs and ahs about gays and God, Satan, fascists, the CIA, and far-fetched geopolitical nightmares. Ensuring that the country was always off balance and a little paranoid was a way to keep people preoccupied, while encouraging them to look to the strong hand of the Kremlin for protection. In addition to his background in both theater and public relations, Surkov was also a self-styled bohemian who liked to allude to avant-garde artists and postmodernist thinkers. He helped turn Russian television, in Pomerantsev's words, into a kitsch, Putin-worshipping propaganda machine. Not dull and ham-handed like old Soviet TV, but superficially glitzy, in a way that weaponized Western entertainment for Russian ends. Surkov's orchestration of Kremlin propaganda has been described as having a performance art quality to it. Stage-managed spectacle meant less to convey an old-school Soviet message than to create multiple, often conflicting storylines that promote confusion and blur reality and fiction. There is no communist ideology in Putin and Surkov's Russia, just what Pomerantsev called power for power's sake and the accumulation of vast wealth. In the service of this nihilistic vision, Surkov has invoked arguments repudiating the existence of objective truth. He has written that hypocrisy in the rationalistic paradigm of Western civilization is inevitable because speech is too linear, too formal to fully reflect the so-called reality, and because pretending to be what you are not, to hide your intentions, is the most important technology of biological survival. In Homer's classics, he notes, the earnest Achilles is less compelling than the cunning Odysseus, a kind of trickster hero, adept at lies and deceit, who is the one who survives. All narratives are contingent, Surkov suggests, and all politicians are liars. Therefore, the alternative facts put out by the Kremlin, and by Donald Trump, are just as valid as anyone else's. In November 2017, the Russian site RT published an essay by Surkov that invoked Derrida-inspired arguments about the unreliability of language and the gap between words and meaning to suggest that Western notions of truthfulness and transparency are naive and unsophisticated. At once arch and convoluted, the piece embodied Surkov's transactional view of the world, privileging irony over sincerity, trickery over earnestness, while name-dropping pop allusions, like the heavy metal band Five Finger Death Punch. Surkov approvingly quoted the lyrics to Wash It All Away. Surkov's essay ends with a portentous account about how the Roman Empire replaced the Roman Republic, suggesting that the Republic failed because it became entangled in its sophisticated system of checks and balances and needed the help of a simple imperial vertical. He ominously suggests that America, too, is waiting to be pulled from growing chaos by a strong hand, an argument that echoes the thinking of a right-wing, anti-democratic philosophy known as neo-reaction, or NRX, which is gathering followers in the United States and envisions the elevation of a leader who would run the country as a kind of unshackled CEO. The King of the West, Surkov wrote in his RT essay, the founder of the digital dictatorship. The leader, with semi-artificial intelligence, has already been predicted by comic books. Why do not these comic books come true? 9. The Schadenfreude of the Trolls. Introduce a little anarchy. Upset the established order, and everything becomes chaos. I'm an agent of chaos. The Joker in the Dark Knight. While Surkov seems intent on exporting Russian nihilism to the West, along with anti-democratic principles and a disdain for truth, America has been grappling with a growing cynicism of its own. And fueled by mistrust and some goading from the far right, that cynicism was beginning to calcify in the opening decades of the 21st century into a kind of homegrown nihilism. It was partly a byproduct of disillusion with a grossly dysfunctional political system that runs on partisan warfare, partly a sense of dislocation in a world reeling from technological change, globalization, and data overload, and partly a reflection of dwindling hopes among the middle class that the basic promises of the American dream, an affordable house, a decent education, and a brighter future for their kids, were achievable in a post-2008 crash United States. While the too-big-to-fail banks paid little price for the crash of 2008, many working people were still trying to make up lost ground. Income inequality was rising, the cost of a college education had exploded, and affordable housing was slipping out of reach. It's a mindset that made a lot of voters susceptible to Trump's attacks on the status quo, and that made some try to churlishly rationalize his transactional politics and shamelessness. Why get upset by his lies when all politicians lie? Why get upset by his venality when the law of the jungle rules? In this respect, Donald Trump is as much a symptom of the times as he is a dangerous catalyst. That he broke most of his promises with astonishing alacrity only served to increase many people's cynicism, a mood that is not conducive to civic engagement, and that ironically fuels Trump's attacks on our ideals and our institutions. As his own books make clear, Trump is completely lacking in empathy and has always had a dog-eat-dog view of the world, kill or be killed and always get even. It's a relentlessly dark view, shaped by his domineering father, Fred, who gave him a zero-sum perspective, and by his early mentor, Roy Cohn, who gave him the advice when in trouble, attack, attack, attack. The world is a horrible place, Trump declared in his book, Think Big. Lions kill for food, but people kill for sport. And the same burning greed that makes people loot, kill, and steal in emergencies like fires and floods operates daily in normal everyday people. It lurks right beneath the surface, and when you least expect it, it rears its nasty head and bites you. Accept it. The world is a brutal place. People will annihilate you just for the fun of it, or to show off to their friends. Trump defines himself largely through the people and institutions he attacks. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, James Comey, the press, the intelligence agencies, the FBI, the judiciary, anyone he perceives as a rival or a threat. And he always seems on the lookout for an enemy or a scapegoat, insulting immigrants, Muslims, women, and African Americans. Much of his agenda, for that matter, is driven by negativity, by an urge to undo President Obama's legacy, including health care and environmental protection, and also to dismantle the broader safety net and civil liberties protections implemented since Lyndon B. Johnson launched the Great Society back in the mid-1960s. Make America Great Again translates into turning the clock back to the 1950s, before the civil rights movement, before the women's movement, before LGBT rights, before Black Lives Matter. But Trump is hardly alone in his negativity and nihilism. Many Republicans in Congress have also abandoned reason, common sense, and the deliberative process of policymaking. Some freely acknowledged that they voted for the tax bill because of their big money donors. Representative Chris Collins said, "My donors are basically saying, get it done or don't ever call me again." Congress has failed to act on immigration reform again and again, and it's refused to act on gun control year after year, tragedy after tragedy. When it comes to dealing with President Trump, many of these same Republicans simply ignore his multiplying lies, his appointment of woefully unqualified nominees to important government posts, his haphazard and cavalier scuttling of decades of domestic and foreign policy, his reckless decision-making, which often seems to emerge, to use Pynchon's words in Gravity's Rainbow, from a chaos of peeves, whims, hallucinations, and all-round assholery. They might confide their worries about Trump's competence or stability to reporters, off the record, of course, but they won't say so in public for fear of jeopardizing their standing with Trump's base. This sort of cynical partisanship only serves to turn voters' disgust with the government into a self-fulfilling prophecy. The nihilism in Washington is both an echo and a cause of more widespread feelings, a reflection of a growing loss of faith in institutions, and a loss of respect for both the rule of law and everyday norms and traditions. A symptom of our loss of civility, our growing inability to have respectful debates with people who have opinions different from our own, and our growing unwillingness to give others the benefit of the doubt, room for an honest mistake, the courtesy of a hearing. It's a sense that life is random and devoid of meaning, combined with a carelessness about consequences. Think of the Buchanans in The Great Gatsby. They were careless people, Tom and Daisy. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together and let other people clean up the mess they had made. And it's reflected in the cult popularity of Fight Club and Michelle Welbeck's willfully repellent novels and the mainstream appreciation of bleakly brilliant works like Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men and Nick Pizzolatto's HBO series True Detective. The new nihilism is WikiLeaks failing to scrub the names of Afghan civilians who might have had contact with American troops from classified U.S. documents it released, a move that human rights groups like Amnesty International warned could have deadly ramifications for the people named. The new nihilism is people making money by creating fake news stories. By one estimate, upward of $10,000 a month earned through online ads. NPR reported that one entirely fictional story with this headline, FBI agent suspected in Hillary email leaks found dead in apparent murder-suicide, was shared on Facebook more than 500,000 times and was created by a California-based company named Disinfo Media that oversees several fake news sites. The founder of Disinfo Media, identified by NPR as one Justin Kohler, claimed that he started the company to show how easily fake news spreads and that he enjoys the game. He said that he and his writers tried to do similar things to liberals, but those efforts didn't go viral, the way stories aimed at Trump supporters do. The new nihilism is Michael Anton, who became a senior national security official in the Trump administration, writing an article under the pseudonym Plubius Decius Moose, titled The Flight 93 Election, in which he compared the plight of voters in 2016 to that of the passengers on the doomed airplane that went down on 9/11, and compared voting for Trump to charging the cockpit. "Charge the cockpit or you die," he wrote. "You may die anyway. You, or the leader of your party, may make it into the cockpit and not know how to fly or land the plane. There are no guarantees, except one. If you don't try, death is certain." The new nihilism manifests itself in grotesque acts of cruelty, like trolling the grieving parents of children murdered in Sandy Hook, and accusing them of perpetrating a hoax, and similar attacks on the students who survived the Parkland School massacre. Given such events, it's not surprising that one of the most popular words in the Trump era is weaponize, as in weaponizing irony, weaponizing fear, weaponizing memes, weaponizing lies, weaponizing the tax code. The most appalling, racist, sexist, and perversely cruel remarks are served up on social media, often with a wink or a sneer. And when called out, practitioners frequently respond that they were simply joking, much the way that White House aides say Trump is simply joking or misunderstood when he makes offensive remarks. At a November 2016 alt-right conference, the white supremacist Richard Spencer ended his speech, shouting, "Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!" When asked about the Nazi salutes that greeted his exclamation, Spencer replied that they were clearly done in a spirit of irony and exuberance. As the researchers Alice Marwick and Rebecca Lewis suggest in their Media Manipulation and Disinformation Online study, ironic fascism can become a kind of gateway drug, leading to the unironic version. A 4chan troll may be more receptive to serious white supremacist claims after using ethnic slurs ironically for 2 or 3 months. In fact, the Huffington Post reported that the neo-Nazi site, the Daily Stormer, which aims to spread the message of nationalism and anti-Semitism to the masses, has a style guide for writers. It provides suggestions like always blame the Jews for everything, approved lists of racial slurs, and this chilling tip on using humor, the tone of the site should be light. The unindoctrinated should not be able to tell if we are joking or not, the author of the style guide advised. There should also be a conscious awareness of mocking stereotypes of hateful racists. I usually think of this as self-deprecating humor. I am a racist making fun of stereotypes of racists because I don't take myself super seriously. This is obviously a ploy, and I actually do want to gas Kikes, but that's neither here nor there. Trump, of course, is a troll, both by temperament and by habit. His tweets and offhand taunts are the very essence of trolling. The lies, the scorn, the invective, the trash talk, and the rabid non sequiturs of an angry, aggrieved, isolated, and deeply self-absorbed adolescent who lives in a self-constructed bubble and gets the attention he craves from bashing his enemies and trailing clouds of outrage and dismay in his path. Even as president, he continues to troll individuals and institutions, tweeting and retweeting insults, fake news, and treacherous innuendo. On Christmas Eve of 2017, he retweeted an image showing a splotch of blood labeled CNN on the sole of his shoe, once again denigrating the press. When another Twitter user called him the most superior troll on the whole of Twitter in 2013, Trump replied, "A great compliment." In his revealing 2017 book, Devil's Bargain, the journalist Joshua Green reported that in the wake of Gamergate, Steve Bannon recruited a lot of gamers, young, alienated, mostly white men, to Breitbart. Although many were not particularly ideologically inclined to begin with, they were eager to throw bombs at the establishment and saw Trump as a kind of kindred soul. Trump himself, Green writes, would help cement this alt-right alliance by retweeting images of Pepe the Frog and occasional missives, always inadvertently, his staff insisted, from white nationalist Twitter accounts. Some trolls have employed relativistic arguments to insist that their promotion of alternative facts is simply adding a voice to the conversation, that there are no more objective truths anymore, only different perceptions and different storylines. They are clearly using postmodernist arguments in bad faith, but their assertions are no more disingenuous, really, than the efforts of Paul DeMann's defenders to explain away his anti-Semitism by using deconstruction to argue that the articles he wrote for a pro-Nazi publication in the 1940s didn't really mean what they appear to mean. Deconstruction, in fact, is deeply nihilistic, implying that the efforts of journalists and historians to ascertain the best available truths through the careful gathering and weighing of evidence are futile. It suggests that reason is an outdated value, that language is not a tool for communication, but an unstable and deceptive interface that is constantly subverting itself. Proponents of deconstruction don't believe that the intent of an author confers meaning on a text. They think that's up to the reader/viewer/recipient. And many postmodernists go so far as to suggest that the idea of individual responsibility is overrated, as the scholar Christopher Butler puts it, for promoting a far too novelistic and bourgeois belief in the importance of individual human agency in preference to an attribution to underlying economic structures. In the 1960s, when postmodernism took off in Europe and the United States, it was an anti-authoritarian doctrine, proposing an overthrow of old humanistic traditions, and as its tenets of irony, self-consciousness, and sarcasm leaked into popular culture, it could be seen, as David Foster Wallace observed in the early 1990s, as an antidote to the hypocrisy and smugness of the 1950s world of Leave It to Beaver. It was a bad boy means of exploding old pieties and conventions at a time when the world seemed increasingly absurd. It also led to some genuinely innovative and daring art, like Wallace's own Infinite Jest. In a long essay about contemporary culture, Wallace argued that while postmodern irony could be a potent instrument for blowing things up, it was essentially a critical and destructive theory, good at ground clearing, yet singularly unuseful when it comes to constructing anything to replace the hypocrisies it debunks. Its promulgation of cynicism made writers wary of sincerity and retro values like originality, depth, and integrity, he wrote. It shielded the heaper of scorn from scorn, while congratulating the patron of scorn for rising above the mass of people who still fall for outmoded pretensions. The attitude of, "I don't really mean what I say," would be adopted by those alt-right trolls who wanted to pretend that they weren't really bigots. They were just joking. Two of the celebrities Wallace held up in 1993 as symbols of the poisonousness of postmodernist irony can now be seen, in retrospect, as harbingers of Trump. The first was Joe Isuzu, the star of jokey 1980s Isuzu car commercials, an oily, satanic-looking salesman, in Wallace's words, who told Whoppers about Isuzu's genuine llama skin upholstery and ability to run on tap water, a parody of a dishonest salesman who invited viewers to congratulate themselves for getting the joke. Joe Isuzu liked to say, "You have my word on it," while a silent disclaimer ran over the footage of his boasts. He's lying. A second celebrity Wallace held up as a tower of 1990s postmodern irony was Rush Limbaugh, whom he described as embodying a hatred that winks and nudges you and pretends it's just kidding. The trickle-down legacy of postmodernism, Wallace argued, was sarcasm, cynicism, a manic ennui, suspicion of all authority, suspicion of all constraints on conduct, and a terrible penchant for ironic diagnosis of unpleasantness, instead of an ambition not just to diagnose and ridicule, but to redeem. You've got to understand that this stuff has permeated the culture. It's become our language. Postmodern ironies become our environment, the water in which we swim. Epilogue. In his clear-eyed 1985 book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, Neil Postman argued that the technological distractions made possible by the electric plug were indelibly altering our cultural discourse, making it more trivial, more inconsequential, and rendering the information it conveyed simplistic, non-substantive, non-historical, and non-contextual. That is to say, information packaged as entertainment. Our priests and presidents, our surgeons and lawyers, our educators and newscasters, Postman wrote, need worry less about satisfying the demands of their discipline than the demands of good showmanship. By electric plug, Postman meant television, but his observations apply even more fittingly to the age of the internet, in which data overload ensures that it's the shiniest object, the loudest voice, the most outrageous opinion, that captures our attention and receives the most clicks and buzz. In Amusing Ourselves to Death, Postman compared the dystopian vision that Aldous Huxley mapped out in Brave New World, in which people lead soporific lives, deadened by drugs and frivolous entertainments, with the one Orwell created in 1984, in which people live under the crushing autocratic rule of Big Brother. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information, Postman wrote. Huxley feared those who would give us so much that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. As Postman saw it, Huxley's dystopia was already coming to fruition in the late 20th century. While Orwell's fears of a totalitarian state applied to the Soviet Union, Postman argued, the threat to the liberal democracies of the West, this was in 1985, remember, was better represented by Huxley's nightmare of a population too narcotized by undisguised trivialities to engage as responsible citizens. These observations of Postman's were ahead of their time, and they would be echoed by George Saunders, who, in an essay titled The Braindead Megaphone, 2007, argued that our national discourse had been dangerously degraded by years of coverage of O.J. Simpson and Monica Lewinsky. Our national language, he wrote, had become so dumbed down, at once aggressive, anxiety-provoking, maudlin, polarizing, that we were sitting ducks when it came time to try to have a serious debate about whether to invade Iraq, and all we had in our hands was the set of crude, hyperbolic tools we'd been using to discuss O.J. et al., the shouted babblings of a loud know-it-all, know-nothing figure he called Megaphone Guy, bellowing into a bullhorn, its intelligence level set to stupid, its volume stuck on drown out all others. But prescient as Postman's observations about Huxley are, and as prescient as Huxley was about our new age of distraction, it's clear that he also underestimated the relevance of Orwell's dystopia. Or perhaps it's the case that Trump and the assaults he and his administration have committed against the very idea of truth have made 1984 timely again, something readers recognized, propelling it and Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism up the bestseller lists in the month that Trump took the oath of office. Trump's lies, his efforts to redefine reality, his violation of norms and rules and traditions, his mainstreaming of hate speech, his attacks on the press, the judiciary, the electoral system, all are reasons that the democracy watchdog group Freedom House warned that year one of the Trump administration had brought further, faster erosion of America's own democratic standards than at any other time in memory. And all are reasons that Orwell's portrait of an authoritarian state, in which Big Brother tries to control all narratives and define the present and the past, is newly relevant. Trump often seems like a one-man set of Aesop-like fables, with easy-to-decipher morals like, those who lie down with dogs will get up with fleas, or, when someone tells you who he is, believe him. But because he is president of the United States, his actions do not simply end in a tagline moral. Rather, they ripple outward like a toxic tsunami, creating havoc in the lives of millions. Once he has left office, the damage he has done to American institutions and the country's foreign policy will take years to repair. And to the degree that his election was a reflection of larger dynamics in society, from the growing partisanship in politics, to the profusion of fake stories on social media, to our isolation in filter bubbles, his departure from the scene will not restore truth to health and well-being. At least, not right away. Philip Roth said he could never have imagined that the 21st century catastrophe to befall the USA, the most debasing of disasters, would appear in the ominously ridiculous commedia dell'arte figure of the boastful buffoon. Trump's ridiculousness, his narcissistic ability to make everything about himself, the outrageousness of his lies, and the profundity of his ignorance can easily distract attention from the more lasting implications of his story. How easily Republicans in Congress enabled him, undermining the whole concept of checks and balances set in place by the founders. How a third of the country passively accepted his assaults on the Constitution. How easily Russian disinformation took root in a culture where the teaching of history and civics had seriously atrophied. George Washington's farewell address of 1796 was eerily clairvoyant about the dangers America now faces. In order to protect its future, he said, the young country must guard its constitution and remain vigilant about efforts to sabotage the separation and balance of powers within the government that he and the other founders had so carefully crafted. Washington warned about the rise of cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men who might try to subvert the power of the people and usurp for themselves the reins of government, destroying afterwards the very engines which have lifted them to unjust dominion. He warned about the insidious wiles of foreign influence and the dangers of ambitious, corrupted, or deluded citizens who might devote themselves to a favorite foreign nation in order to betray or sacrifice the interests of America. And, finally, Washington warned of the continual mischiefs of the spirit of party, which are given to creating strife through ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, and the perils that factionalism, East versus West, North versus South, State versus Federal, pose to the unity of the country. Citizens, he said, must indignantly frown upon the first dawning of every attempt to alienate any portion of our country from the rest, or to enfeeble the sacred ties which now link together the various parts. America's founding generation spoke frequently of the common good. Washington reminded citizens of their common concerns and common interests and the common cause they had all fought for in the Revolution. And Thomas Jefferson spoke in his inaugural address of the young country uniting in common efforts for the common good. A common purpose and a shared sense of reality mattered because they bound the disparate states and regions together, and they remain essential for conducting a national conversation. Especially today, in a country where President Trump and Russian and alt-right trolls are working to incite the very factionalism Washington warned us about, trying to inflame divisions between people over racial, ethnic, and religious lines, between red states and blue states, between small towns and big cities. There are no easy remedies, but it's essential that citizens defy the cynicism and resignation that autocrats and power-hungry politicians depend upon to subvert resistance. The inspiring students who survived the Parkland, Florida massacre have done just that, rejecting the fatalism of many of their elders. By turning their grief into action, they are changing the national dialogue and leading the charge to get real gun control measures enacted that could help prevent others from suffering the terror and loss they experienced. At the same time, citizens must look to and protect the institutions the founders created as pillars to uphold the roof of democracy. The three branches of government, executive, legislative, and judicial, meant to serve as reciprocal checks, in Washington's words, on one another. And the other two foundation stones of democracy that the founders agreed were crucial for creating an informed public that could wisely choose its leaders: education and a free and independent press. Jefferson wrote that because the young republic was predicated on the proposition that man may be governed by reason and truth, our first object should therefore be to leave open to him all the avenues to truth. The most effectual hitherto found is the freedom of the press. It is therefore the first shut up by those who fear the investigation of their actions. I hold it, therefore, certain, Jefferson went on, that to open the doors of truth and to fortify the habit of testing everything by reason are the most effectual manacles we can rivet on the hands of our successors to prevent their manacling the people with their own consent. Madison, somewhat more succinctly, put it like this: a popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Without commonly agreed upon facts, not Republican facts and Democratic facts, not the alternative facts of today's silo world, there can be no rational debate over policies, no substantive means of evaluating candidates for political office, and no way to hold elected officials accountable to the people. Without truth, democracy is hobbled. The founders recognized this, and those seeking democracy's survival must recognize it today.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Death of Truth, Notes on Falsehood in the Age of Trump, by Michiko Kakutani, read by Tavia Gilbert. This program was directed by Maureen Monterubio, executive producer Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2018 by Michiko Kakutani. Production copyright 2018 Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.